A.S. Byatt, there's a comment you made about the children's book that I am a tarnished person because you can't write a novel like the children's book without reading a great number of memoirs.
Yes, I used tarnished rather desperately. I was at an event at the Edinburgh Literature Festival and didn't know that journalists were in the audience who were going to put this up and flag it in a newspaper. I was saying that I think memoirs always are dangerous, both to the writer and to the people written about. And then I sort of realised that I'd read an awful lot, so I said, well, I'm tarnished because I've had to read so many for writing this book. But you read them in a very odd way if you're looking for things to turn into fiction rather than inhabiting the facts.
This is one way. I mean, you're seeing through a person's eyes the world that you're trying to envision. So
yes.
It gives you a perspective.
Yes, it does. What I look for in the memoirs is more sort of what sort of clothes they had and, you know, getting the actual groundwork of it right. And occasionally, if they think things I hadn't realised people did think. It's surprising how most memoirs resemble each other, really.
You know, as I was reading the book, I was not necessarily focusing on how it relates to me today until I noticed a vast increase between, I don't know, 1905 and the start of the war in violence, in terrorism, levels that we don't even experience today that I didn't know exist, culminating in this flash of anger and murder, which was World War One.
It was very strange. There were going to be, and in some sense were, violent strikes among the working people already arising in Britain, certainly, and in America. And there was the execution in Chicago of the trades unionists. I read a lot about American anarchists, and then I read a lot about French and German anarchists. And when I first read Conrad's The Secret Agent, I thought he'd invented it all, but he was actually reporting a blowing up that had happened and people who did blowing up, and he knew them. I don't know that that caused the First World War. My theory about the First World War, and I'm not a historian, came to be that it was caused because the Kaiser was mad, period. It's odd because the European history is a family story, like my novel, writ large. And there was the Kaiser with his relations sitting on all the thrones of Europe, trying not to be snubbed by them, trying to fight them, hating Nicholas of Russia, wanting to be Queen Victoria's favourite grandson. And he kept sort of thinking he would make a war. And then he tried to make an alliance in another direction. When he had actually declared the war and sent out, I think it was 11,000 trucks full of troops, he thought he could stop it again. And he went to his general and said, you know, I've been talking to the English. They say they won't support the French. It's all right. We don't have to have this war. I don't think the war was part of the same swelling up of rage that was going on in the working people.
The result was
appalling.
Catastrophic. I mean, you make mention in some of the final pages that there was one day that 40,000 men were killed going up against machine guns, and they kept coming.
They kept coming. My puppet metaphor came in because they kept coming, and they had been told that the wire was cut in the trenches they were advancing on. It was not cut, so they just hung like dead puppets on the wire. And I read a lot about Passchendaele, which was simply a sea of mud, because when the Germans came, the Belgians and the Dutch broke the dikes and flooded everything. So it was just deep, deep mud. And they'd built all these wooden walkways across the mud where they ran to the soldiers at the front with packs of hot food on their backs. And if anyone fell in, they didn't get him out because it would take a very long time to pull him out of the mud and they probably wouldn't be able to. They just went on running. So, you know, if you fell in the mud, you were dead. And reading again the memoirs, in fact, the memoirs of Edmund Blunden, a wonderful poet who wrote a very good book about his time in the war. And he said he was in a trench where there were two young brothers from the same family and they were laughing and talking together. And one of them's head was just shot off like that. And he said the other one, in fact, went mad and sort of stood up and attracted a bullet. Then the army made a rule that two brothers shouldn't be in the same company.
A fictionalized version of that occurs in
the book. Yeah. Yes, it does. It was odd details like that that made you see just how terrible it was. And then you read the generals sort of saying a loss of 40,000 men, you know, is acceptable. Who is accepting it? On whose behalf? I was brought up by pacifists, whereas my husband's father at the age of 15 claimed to be 16 and volunteered for the First World War. And my husband has his father's diary of going through the trenches. And his father rather respected the Germans but came to hate the French. And he was buried upside down in the mud at the Somme. And he didn't tell my husband until he was quite old and not far from his death. Then he told him this story. And he said that the thing that really frightened him was that he thought when they were digging him out, they would just slice him. And that was just one young man who should never have gone there.
I kept thinking, well, we see in the United States the swelling paroxysm of anger, inchoate anger, spreading across the land. I mean, it's exacerbated by Fox News and places like that, but that anger is there, and I'm fearful. You know, are we headed for World War I?
We're headed for something, and we've already got two unnecessary wars, in my view. The Iraq War may have had deep political reasons that we were never told about or be to do with the oil, really, but it's a stupid war from the point of view of any reason that was given for fighting it. I spent a lot of time arguing with the Europeans about the Afghan war, because when it started, it seemed to me that the United States had to do something. And if they had gone in and looked for Osama bin Laden and come out again, I was prepared to support them. But I mean, this war is doing nothing, it's achieving nothing, except it's siphoning off some of this anger. And I opened my New York Times yesterday, and there was the list of the men who had been killed the day before in Afghanistan. And I thought, it's just like my novel. You're implying it's not big enough yet. There's still some more to come.
I also know that the paroxysm of anger that erupted in World War I, 20 years later, came back in even worse condition. I mean, World War II makes World War I pale in comparison.
World War II is much more complicated, because I think if the French had not required such reparations from the Germans, we might not have had Hitler, and then we might not have had World War II. But the swelling up of sort of appalling theories in Germany is very like the phenomenon here that you've just talked about, people with absolutely bigoted, irrational beliefs about things. Everything was caused by the Jews. Everything is now caused by the Muslims. I find it very frightening because I was born and lived my childhood during the Second World War. And when it came to an end, we were very, very tired, and we didn't have quite enough food, and we didn't have any very nice things. But we had this sense that things would now start getting better. And in fact, it was when the sort of pseudo-violence of the 60s and 70s came along, and first you got hippies and then you got Charles Manson, that I saw that there is a cycle that goes on and on forever. You get tired, then you're peaceful, then you're childish, then you get over-agitated, and then somehow it all bursts. You'd feel it could be stopped. Most of the scientists I know think that we shall become extinct as an animal sooner rather than later.
The idea of denial of global warming is just so appalling, and it doesn't make any sense. I mean, why are we so involved for petty reasons in destroying not only ourselves but our environment?
Because we're very short-sighted animals and we're greedy, and we will not forego an immediate pleasure for the sake of something in the future. And this is particularly true of people who have made themselves wonderful lives out of digging up oil and coal and flying about in private jets. They can't quite bring themselves to have a little less of those things. Again, it's short-sightedness, really. Our governments are elected. Democracy is a very good thing. No government has long enough to do anything about what we're doing to the world before it gets kicked out. I mean, President Obama is endangered. I think he has a very clear idea of what ought to be done for the world. And he's tried to do various things for the world. And everybody I meet in America complains one way or the other. They complain that he hasn't done enough, though he lives in the world we've been talking about. How could he have done much more than he has, is my view from England. Or they complain that he's the wrong sort of person trying to do the wrong thing. We're not very clever, really. I was talking to somebody at lunch about how much I like eating vegetables, and then I read an article about how the lovely little spears of fresh asparagus I so enjoy cooking farmed on vast agricultural businesses in Peru, which are taking away the water out of the water table at immense speed, and the villages have no longer got any water, and the people who work on the agribusinesses are having to drink contaminated water. And then, of course, you ought to stop it. You see, even me, I haven't stopped eating my asparagus. I think there's a Darwinian reason. I think we are just not able to think that out. We're able to do the mining and drive the SUVs. And there was a review of Jonathan Franzen in England which talked about a man who had one of those huge Subarus, and he said, it's my absolute right to have something as big as I can possibly have. And I don't know where we get the right to stop him.